Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. An endless flow of water links every part of our existence. Our forebears realized this and never took it for granted. They knew that their lives, their sustenance, well-being, and bodily health depended on this erratic and completely indifferent substance. He also writes that he has been thinking about water for a long time. He has spent most of his time, Brian Fagan that is, in most of his life in semi-arid landscapes where every drop counts, or on passage in small boats for days on end with only tanks and jerry cans to rely on. He refuses to think of water as a commodity like electricity, gravel, or oil. Our blue planet has many gifts to bestow, but none of them approach that of water, truly our lifeblood. Well, Brian Fagan has written one heck of a book. Elixir is the name of it, A History of Water and Humankind. I can't believe the amount of work that must have gone into this history, because it's not just a history of water in the United States. He has traveled all over the world, Brian has, and he's looked at, read the history of water all over the world as well, in China, in Africa, in Bali, in South America, in Europe. So we're talking about a history of water that goes back thousands of years. Plus, he concentrates on water concerns that we should have in 2011. So it's an amazing piece of work. I was reading it, a good chunk of it, last night. And I got to tell you, I usually take a lot of notes just, you know, because I'm still in school when I do this show. But I've got pages and pages and pages of notes because it was fascinating. Brian is Emeritus Professor of Anthropology at the University of California, Santa Barbara, born in England, spent several years doing field work in Africa. His other books include The Great Warming, which is a New York Times bestseller, Fish on Friday, Fasting and the Discovery of the New World, Cro-Magnon, several books on climate history, The Little Ice Age and The Long Summer. And he, in this book, talks about how every human society has been shaped by its relationship to our most essential resource, water. He is with us, I'm happy to say, this hour. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. Professor Brian Fagan, thank you so much for being with us.
Very much my pleasure. It's nice to be back.
Yeah, it's nice to have you here. What a piece of work this is. Holy cow. I can't believe how much work went into this. It's phenomenal. It's very interesting as well, but it's phenomenal all that you've covered, isn't it?
It was a huge job. It took about 3 years, and it all began with an organization called the Water Policy Conference in California, which I gave a talk to about drought, ancient drought, and they said, why don't you write a history of water? And here it is. Hell of an undertaking.
But you not only just did a history of water in the United States, you took on the whole world, sir.
Well, you can't understand the history of water without looking at the world, because there were so many diverse ways of managing it and thinking about it. And that was the fun of it.
Mm-hmm. You have traveled to various parts of the world. You're very familiar with Africa because you spent several years doing field work in Africa. Why don't we start there? And let's go way, way back to the remote past and the early age of water in whatever country you would like to talk about in Africa. You detail in the early part of the book some of your work there and some history of water in some African countries.
The thing that's absolutely fascinating about Africa is that an awful lot of very ancient irrigation techniques are still being used there. And when researching the book, I came by chance across the work of a young archaeologist stroke anthropologist called Matthew Davies, who studied the irrigation agriculture of people called the Marakwet up in northeastern Kenya. And these people who live in the highlands bring water from streams up at the top of the hill down to their fields, down narrow furrows. And these furrows are dug with very careful attention to the gradient. They go around boulders. They use hollow tree trunks to move the water. And when they get the water to their fields, they distribute it, as you might put it, by discussion. And the whole water allocation thing is thwart with all sorts of complex political issues. And this was an absolutely fascinating insight into the ways in which people probably managed water 10,000 years ago. And having myself spent years in Africa when I was young and witnessed subsistence agriculture, this was a real wake-up call that this is still going on, because Africa has frightening water problems, as indeed do other parts of the world. And many subsistence farmers are in real danger of starvation if we get sustained drought in the future.
Were there more instances of people fighting and maybe even violence over who had access to water and who owned the water? Or more than not, were there calm discussions because so many families were involved about how things could be shared?
In my experience, and of course my experience of these things is relatively limited in Africa, it was a matter of discussion.
Mm-hmm.
You might get people fighting a little bit, but when you're talking about large-scale wars, no, you're not. Talking about disputes, because a great deal of water management of this type is done between kin groups, between families, between villages, and in the final analysis, it's in everyone's interest to have water. And so they normally resolve it with the aid of rituals, and there are ceremonies at certain types of the year, or used to be, which invoked mythic beings and so on, kin leaders, legendary ancestors, and these mechanisms help diffuse violence.
Let's talk about the how people saw water is this not only important resource as the elixir, but also they saw it as something almost to be worshipped, that water finds its way into the Bible and the Quran and wonderful poetry, that it's so important that we thank the gods for it.
Oh, and so they should. I was very lucky in high school. I had an absolutely fabulous Homer teacher who taught me Homer.
Oh.
And one of the memorable remarks I remember this man making many, many years ago was saying, "Ah, behind every spring there was a water nymph." And he was right. Springs were sacred. They were sources of life. And people living in semi-arid lands and people living in challenging environments know the water is a gift. And they revere it, and the gods who used to be associated with water were deeply valued and revered and celebrated. I mean, the ancient Maya, for example, had a huge body of water rituals which surrounded rainfall and the storage of water. But the classic example today are the rice farmers of Bali. I mean, many people go to Bali and think of a tourist paradise. It's also home to one of the most remarkable water management systems anywhere, because thousands of rice farmers draw their water supplies from ultimately streams that run down from a volcanic lake in the highlands. And the distribution of this water is closely connected to temples, to temple congregations, who are the people who actually farm the land, to the distribution of holy water in jars, which comes from the volcanoes up at the top, which provide the water, and it passed out from temple to temple. They have an intimate part of the water distribution of local Buddhist ritual, and the whole thing is sustaining in a remarkable way and has worked for many centuries. And this really is a classic example how people realize that water is the center of their life, the source of their crops, the source of life. It's
and
really
remarkable. If they don't pay attention to it, they may collapse. Let's go back to the Mayans for a moment. You spend a lot of time on the Mayans, and say the brilliant success of this remarkable civilization resulted in considerable part from sophisticated water management. Can you talk about that and then how it collapsed, perhaps due to water?
The Maya are a remarkable civilization. They have been studied for years, as you well know. There are probably more Mayan archaeologists in the United States than there are of any other kind of archaeologist. And In recent years, the major center of debate and attention has been the decipherment of the very intricate Maya script. This process now is well along, thanks to the brilliant work of people like David Stewart and others, where we now have an unrivaled understanding of Maya ritual. I mean, there were many things we still didn't know, but it's quite clear that water was one of the central themes of Maya life. Now, until recently, studies of water management among the Maya hadn't really been at center stage. But an important archaeologist named Vernon Scarborough and others, Lisa Lucero and others, have studied water management. And one of the things they've discovered is that the great pyramids of places like Tikal were far more than pyramids where Maya lords appeared and gashed themselves and conducted public ceremonies. They were water catchments, because the water supply, the rainfall in the Maya lowlands, is very irregular, and the storms are often short and violent. And when rain falls on the pyramid, the water gushes down, gushes into reservoirs, and then in the dry season, it's parceled out to surrounding fields. But who controls the water? The lords who have built the pyramids, who preached that they were the link between the living people and the supernatural world and the ancestors and the forces of the environment. And if there were droughts, and sometimes we know this from lake cores, there were prolonged droughts in Maya country. For a couple of years, they might be okay, but the third year, there's no water or very little, and the people will say to the Lord, "Hi, Lord, how are you today? Where's my water?"
Right.
And the Lord has feet of clay. And this was one, and I stress, one of the possible factors that led to the partial collapse of Maya civilization in the 10th century, when there were a series of droughts at about 50-year intervals. And it may well be that these droughts, many of which coincided with the so-called medieval warm period of 1,000 years ago, were one, only one, of the triggers that collapsed the civilization. So it's a fascinating, very intricate story we're only just beginning to understand.
Mm-hmm. In one of your chapters, a hohokam, something that is all gone, you talk about being in a plane and you're going down into Phoenix, and you say you wonder how long it would be before promiscuously expanding Phoenix imploded in the face of chronic water shortages triggered in part by a culture of excess and waste. And then you think about the people who lived there long, long ago, ancient people known as the Hohokam, who farmed the desert for more than 1,000 years. Tell me how they survived over 1,000 years, and as we look at the future of places like Phoenix, what we should think about when we remember people like the Hohokam.
You do ask difficult questions.
Well, you wrote the book, sir. You did the difficult book.
I know. Anyway, no, one of the most interesting things, as you know, when you put a book, comes out on the market, people pick up on stuff in it. And on this book, the subject most people have picked up on, and this is fascinating, has been the Hohokam.
Really?
And people say, "We had no idea there were these people there."
Oh.
Because the Hohokam are almost completely buried under Phoenix. And the way they've been discovered, much of it in the last 10 or 15 years, is by excavation and survey when sites are developed within the city. And from this, they have reconstructed the networks of Hohokam irrigation systems, which were first really spotted way back in the 19th century. And we now know that these remarkable people farmed using water, irrigation water, taken from the Gila and Salt and other rivers and distributed in networks of canals, again using gravity. Gravity is really one of the central themes of the history of water everywhere. And these people, again, it was kin-based, family-based, and eventually chief-based, survived for 1,000 years doing
Goodness.
This. In the end, things fell apart a bit, and this is a very complicated story, perhaps as a result of some droughts which caused the water to be less reliable, but they were replaced by other peoples. And this form of agriculture lasted for hundreds of years under where Phoenix is now. But if you look at Phoenix, where, and this is really a part of the book, kind of at the end, you are looking at what the Industrial Revolution has wrought, because with the Industrial Revolution, you got fossil fuels, steam, electric, diesel, and the ability to pump from hundreds of feet below the ground. So we've started drawing groundwater. And much of Phoenix is fueled by water from the Colorado, from other sources, by canals, and by groundwater. Now, some of the aquifers which are being exploited in the United States generally are not self-sustaining. They're not replenishing themselves. And there's only a finite amount of water on Earth. And the question one has to ask in an era of increasing drought is Phoenix sustainable? And people say, technology will allow us to solve this problem. But if they go on paving the desert like they are now and don't really think about this, I really wonder if it is. And to fly into Phoenix, as I did, is very scary because you see this huge city in the desert, and you see spots which are green golf courses and swimming pools, and you really wonder, is this sustainable? I don't know. I mean, people obviously will try very hard to make it sustainable, and there were remarkable experiments in Nevada where water districts are sharing water and so on, but really, one does ask the question.
Yes. What about, there's a chapter in other words on this throughout other chapters, the waters of Islam. If I hadn't been looking at your book and reading your book, I would have thought, why in the world would people live in ancient times in areas that were desert, that were incredibly arid? But the history of the waters of Islam is pretty amazing. They found a way to live in a very arid climate. Tell me what it was.
In my humble opinion, the two or three greatest water managers of all time have been the Inca of Peru, who had plenty of water, the ancient Greeks, who were remarkable and are much neglected as far as this is concerned, and above all, the water managers of Islam. These people who, of course, lived their entire existence in states of drought, lived with a philosophy that water was the most precious thing on earth. And they are famous, for example, for their gardens, these magnificent palace gardens. Have you been to Granada in Spain?
No, I have not. I've been to other parts of Spain, but okay, I'll go. Okay.
I mean, put it at the high in your travel list, because when you go to the gardens there, you hear the rippling of water. There were serene pools. There are fruit trees. There were lawns. There were flowers. And remember this interview, because that's the essence of water management, is at the one spectrum, the creation of gardens, which are replicas of paradise, which is what they are, because paradise in the Quran is flowing waters, then meadows, and so on. So that's one extreme. And, of course, some of the ancient gardens in places like Iraq were truly legendary. I mean, amazing. They're gone now, many of them. But at the other end of the spectrum, you have people who were absolute maestros at harvesting water in very dry environments. They made maximum use of springs. They used an ingenious device which was invented in ancient Iran called the qanat, which is basically a way of tapping groundwater by tunneling horizontally into the alluvial fans at the mouth of streams, and you tunnel in horizontally, putting up ventilation holes until you tap the groundwater, which you've located before with a vertical shaft. Very dangerous, but extraordinarily effective. And right until the 1950s, for example, much of Tehran was, in fact, relying on qanats for its water supply.
Really?
And you take wells, you take water irrigation from things like the Nile, you put all this together, and if you really want to see it at its ultimate, it's really in Al-Andalus in Spain. And these people wrang water out of the most unlikely environments. And it was no coincidence that the Christian conquerors of Spain took over many of the techniques used by Islamic farmers.
And the let's just spend a moment, and then we'll go to phone calls on desalinization, which some people think is the answer. Julius Caesar was using desalinization. It was mentioned by Aristotle. I didn't know that.
Oh yeah, on a small scale, it's well known that you can do it. It's very interesting. There has been a tidal wave of books on modern water, most of which talk about Armageddon and the impending crisis with a capital C. Yes, there is a quiet crisis, but it's not something we should sort of be waving our arms about. Underneath all this is the search for solutions.
Yes.
And the search at one end of the spectrum is people, technology will care for you, invent, and do this. But that doesn't allow for one thing. There isn't any more water on Earth. We have a finite supply. The cycle is there. Number two is desalinization. The problem with desalinization, apart from the environmental problems with it, which apparently are considerable, I don't know much about it, is that desalinization requires fossil fuels. Hello.
Mm-hmm.
The price of fossil fuels is going through the roof. Really, the only place this is viable with fossil fuels is places like Abu Dhabi, Dubai, where they have oil. And then, of course, people inevitably raise atomic power. We can do this with nuclear power. Then you think of the terrible Japanese tragedy, and you think of mushroom clouds.
Oh, yes, yeah.
And that's off the political table. Apart from all that, you've still got another problem. It's once you've desalinized the water, for the sake of argument, here in Santa Barbara, how are you going to get it to Tucson? Fossil fuels. You've got to drive that through mm-hmm. pipelines. So it's very, very expensive. And although they're talking about much reduced costs, et cetera, I don't know how big a solution it's going to be. Not as big as some people expect.
Brian Fagan is our guest this hour. His latest book is Elixir, A History of Water and Humankind. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address, if you'd like to use that, talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest is Brian Fagan, Emeritus Professor of Anthropology at the University of California, Santa Barbara, author of a number of books. Elixir is the latest, A History of Water and Humankind. We interviewed him most recently on The Great Warming, but he's written many, many other books. Our number, 800-486-8655. Stephen in Sturtevant, hi.
Yes, my name is Stephen, and I spent almost 30 years in Southern California in water research. And there's a very good tale to tell there, in that there are water reclamation programs that combine both current technologies but also natural treatment systems as a way of recycling the water, not in the way that you described with reverse osmosis, but if you have gravity, sunlight, and the proper knowledge of plants and bacteria, a good portion of all the water that has been used can be recycled, percolated into the ground, and it becomes the drinking water source for millions of people.
Professor Fagan.
That's interesting. That's fascinating. Yeah, I'm aware of this. The problem I keep on hearing from people out here who are in the water business is that they have solutions for some of these things and many different tools. Their biggest problem is that people simply deny that there's a water shortage because they take water for granted. They just turn a faucet on and there it is, and they feel entitled to it.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the experiments that are going on are in the shadows or methods that are used, and people aren't aware of them. I'm not that aware of what this gentleman's talking about. I am, after all, an archaeologist.
You know some of what he's talking about, though, because of the history you've done. Do you have a place where people can get more information, Stephen?
What's that again?
Do you have a place where people can get more information about what you speak?
Yes. If they were to look up the Orange County Water District in California, you will see a remarkable story of how you see complete water reclamation, where the wastewater from one part of the state gets recycled, cleaned up, percolated into the ground, purified by the aquifer, and becomes the drinking water supply for 2.5 million people.
Great. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
For your call. If you could spend a few moments, Brian, on the Incas high in the Andes were water engineers. You write about them and the success they had, whereas Mayan civilization collapsed. The Inca civilization survived, you say, drought after drought because of their careful water management.
The most striking thing about, to me, is looking from today backwards, as the most successful water engineers of the past, kind of like the gentleman from Orange County, and I'm going to look this up. It sounds
I'm sure you will.
And important.
Mm-hmm.
Is the power of long-term planning and thinking, where you think way ahead, and where, while you may take water for granted, you're very careful with it. And the Andes are a fascinating example of this, because there's a remarkable, very experienced water engineer and his wife, I describe in the book, who have studied the ways in which the Inca managed water. The Inca and the Andes, of course, have plenty of water. Their problem is moving the water around the landscape. And this is as difficult in some ways as digging a canal in tropical Africa, because gradient and all these factors come in. And this gentleman managed to decipher how water was managed at Machu Picchu, high in the Andes.
Mm-hmm.
And he showed how they tapped the mountain streams, run it in stone-lined canals along mountain slopes, and then let it cascade down past agricultural terraces, and they would tap this in different places so that they would be able to get water for their houses and or collect it in jars, or they could water terraces, agricultural terraces. And it really is extraordinary how they managed to water it. He also has studied, and now his name is Ken Wright, studied a Inca royal estate at a place called Tipon near Cusco, where there's a magnificent set of terraces. And he's shown how the whole countryside was used to water this estate, including an aqueduct, and so on and so forth. But if you go down onto the Peruvian coast, where there are arid lands, very arid, some of the most arid land on Earth, the only water supplies for farming really are mountain runoff from the rivers. And amazing though it may seem, for many centuries, a series of very volatile kingdoms arose along this coast based on irrigation agriculture in these valleys. And over the years, they became much more sophisticated in their management of water. And the Chimú people who live in the Lambayeque Valley actually developed long-term thinking. And they, in a way, almost over-engineered their irrigation systems so that they could connect one valley to another and so forth. But the interesting thing is that they had two polarities. One, which they lived with all the time, was the assumption that there were going to be serious droughts. And the other was that with major El Niños, there'd be too much water. They would have 100-year rains. And if you look closely at their irrigation systems, you find they've engineered in how to get rid of too much water. So it's fascinating. But again, long-term thinking, very precise thinking, permanence, sustainability.
Right. So here's to long-term thinking. Here's to long-term thinking.
Yeah, terribly, very, very important. Because the Chimú lords who ran this place had no illusions. They knew their power depended on the efficiency of their water management.
Eugene and Viola, hi.
Good morning, Kathleen. These high-capacity wells, they proposed one about 20 miles south of it down at Gaze Mills. What effect will those high-capacity wells, or will they have, on the streams and the springs and the water table? And I'll take my answer off the air.
I'm sorry, I didn't correctly hear the question.
The high-capacity wells, are you familiar with those, Brian?
No.
Okay. I'm sorry, Eugene. We'll have to do another show on that. This looks more at, well, obviously Brian knows a lot about water, but this looks at water usage in various civilizations all over the world.
It is very interesting, actually, Kathleen, that whatever I lecture about this subject, which I do quite a bit, an awful lot of the questions are from people who are worried about modern water and have just been fed a diet from the newspapers, most of which is unreliable, who are unaware of, like I am, of these things, and of course of the Orange County experiment and this sort of thing. And really an awful lot of stuff is that the public don't know about it, and all they hear is Armageddon. They don't hear what solutions there are. Can you support this? Look what our tax dollars are doing. So it's very frustrating in a way, being an archaeologist, being asked these questions.
Well, we need to remember the past, too. Let's spend a few moments on China, please, where we have the South doing okay with water, lots of rain, the North fairly arid, and what the Chinese are doing and have done to supply some of the rain from the South to the North.
The Chinese are a fascinating hydrological story. To summarize a very, very complex history, the Chinese technique, or used by many emperors, was simply dig a canal, and they would deploy 3,000 people to dig a canal, and the canal might work for a short time and then be a failure, because you've got two or three very diverse hydrological regimes there. In the north, you've got drought, the Huanghe, which is an ecological basket case, too many people living, chronic droughts. I mean, there were droughts caused by monsoon failures in 1878 up near the Yellow River in the north, which killed at least 1.5 million people and probably more. Down in the south, you've got a more tropical regime, you've got much more water. And the Chinese gift, if you can call it that, for major public schemes has seen them, for example, build a canal to carry grain from the south to the north, which was built centuries ago. Now they have built the Three Gorges Dam on the Yangtze, and I hear there are problems with that. And now they are apparently building a waterway to carry water from the south to the drought plague north, to which there has been considerable opposition within China. But they are doing things on a grand scale, and there is a long history, both of major projects, a very few of which have been really truly successful, and of failures. So it's a very interesting case to watch, and it really is water management on a grand scale with a capital G and a capital S. In my humble opinion, and I am ignorant, really, the more local schemes, like again, and I hate to bring it up again, like Steve said this, Orange County system, the more local systems, are far more effective in many ways, if you can do it.
We go to Victor in Milwaukee next. Hi, Victor.
Hi, and welcome to you. Hello to your guests. I have a question concerning the opposite desert, your polar ice caps and civilizations. You know, you have the Russian imperial civilization. How do they manage water from the ice? It's probably localized. I'm not sure, but has anyone thought of that? And I'm pretty sure a lot of environmentalists would argue against that because it causes other problems and arguments. So has your book ever addressed that?
No, I don't really get into that problem. It really is something different. I'm really concerned with water management by ancient societies. There are proposals now, of course, to tow icebergs south or to tank water down from the north and so on. And the whole air issue of melting ice sheets is very complex. And people have harvested water on a local scale from ice for thousands of years.
Let's go to your old stomping grounds, England. You have a very interesting part of the book where you talk about European cities growing, becoming veritable mazes of competing water interests. London, you spend quite a bit of time on London, where as many as 80,000 people lived there by the 13th century, and it was kind of nasty.
It must have been horrible, I would imagine. Victorian London was bad enough. I don't know why anyone wanted to live there. The sanitation was terrible. I mean, there were, as you know, and we talk about it in the book, there were eventually steps taken to improve sanitation and drainage. One of the big problems with European cities, with Roman cities, with Greek cities, wasn't necessarily just enough water to drink. It was sanitation.
Right.
It was getting rid of waste. And one of the most remarkable things about Roman civilization, because this is really relevant to your question, is how they got rid of waste. They relied heavily on big cities like Rome, Trier, and so on aqueducts. And aqueducts, of course, provide a permanent source of flowing water. And what isn't generally known about Roman aqueducts, certainly those of Rome, is that many of them were built by the wealthy or even by emperors, not so much for drinking water, although they were used for that, but to keep baths supplied, public baths. And the public baths, of course, weren't just baths. Yes, you bath, but they were places where people met, where people carried out business deals, flirted, had affairs, conducted political intrigue, conducted religious intrigue, whatever you like. So the supply of water really was sort of fueling activity in the city. And when the water was not used, it was flushed out, and it was used to flush out the public toilets, which were located right by the baths. And if you look at these, they are semicircular, and these were social gatherings. They were, as it were, the Starbucks of Roman times, and a lot of people did business in the toilet. So the water was used to flush out the drains. Not that Rome was particularly sanitary, but it was a little better than some places.
Thanks, Victor, for your call. Let's go to Jerry in Gays Mills. Hi, Gary. Jerry.
Hello. I would like to ask Brian what he, from his study of ancient civilizations, does he think that water should become a national resource or a resource that the government has control over, rather than individuals who want to buy it and sell it. I guess that's part of my concern. Here in Wisconsin, we avoided Perrier from having high-capacity wells, and now we're in dealing with another individual who wants to buy and sell the water that is part of this the Jordan aquifer in our Driftless area.
It's fascinating. These are modern questions. But there were two traditions in history. One is local management of water. This is the concern as it is today of Balinese farmers, East African farmers, many Asian farmers who deal with their water problems locally. This is highly sustainable and effective on a small scale. When the scale of society increases, the population increases, you get a whole set of more complex problems, one of which is simply the access to the water. And the only way you can deal with that is to either bring water into the city or to store it nearby where people can fetch it. Once you start doing that, you really have a case for some form of official, rather dispassionate government control of water supplies. Having said that, one of the most frightening things about today's water problems is that water is rapidly becoming a commercial commodity. Apart from bottled water, you've got French companies buying up the water rights all over Africa, and you've got situations where the price of water in arid lands is going to get more and more expensive, and some people even think it'll get more expensive than gasoline, because water is becoming a marketable commodity. We today live with ludicrously cheap water, far cheaper than the cost of dealing with it, or the Orange County one again, far cheaper than the cost of doing all that. And the question is, how much longer can that go on, simply because the cost of doing it is so expensive, apart from the people who are muscling in and buying and selling it.
So does all of that mean that living next to the Great Lakes will be incredibly desirable down the road, Brian?
I have a suspicion it will, and living in Norway will be wonderful. Yes.
Right.
No, there were people who were thinking about this.
Oh,
yeah.
People are thinking long term. We take more phone calls in a moment. Our guest this hour is Brian Fagan. His latest book is Elixir, A History of Water and Humankind, and it is a totally absorbing read. It covers the history of water from many, 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 many years ago, and so we can learn from the past. He says that this is a book about human relationships with water in the past, the first such work to tackle the subject on a global scale and on such a grand historical scale as well. What can we learn about those civilizations that flourished for a long period of time because they knew what to do and how to conserve their water? 800-486-8655 is our number. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Brian Fagan, our guest, emeritus professor of anthropology at the University of California, Santa Barbara, born in England, as you might be able to tell as he speaks. Let's spend just a little while, Professor Fagan, on colonial rule. You talk about what happened in Bali when there was Dutch colonial rule. There was colonial rule in so many parts of Africa and other parts of the world. Did water management, water conservation change dramatically? Can we learn anything from that long period of colonial rule?
It's varied tremendously from place to place. You've got in Africa, for example, you've got the building of the Kariba Dam on the Zambezi, which has had drastic long-term effects on the indigenous people living particularly upstream, who had relied on the Zambezi flood for agriculture for many, many centuries. You've got the case of Bali, where the Dutch came in and started bringing in new crops, started lining canals with concrete and so on, and it just didn't work. So gradually they reverted to the old system, which is effective. So we don't necessarily have the wisdom. We assume we do, but very often we don't, because the one thing, many of these schemes which may work in Oshkosh, Wisconsin, but don't work in Eastern Africa, really, they discount something, and that is the local people know a lot more about the soil and water mm-hmm. than we do.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the central things in the book is that the rules changed with the Industrial Revolution, which is really when my book ends. And today we're living with millions of people in much more crowded environments where the whole issue of water management is on a completely new scale.
Well, in the Industrial Revolution, as you write, really changed how we thought about water on so many levels. It's no longer something that we worship and that we take very, very good care of,
nope.
But it becomes a commodity.
That's correct. And it's an anonymous commodity, and we forget that billions of people in the world don't have good drinking water.
Right. Let's go to Bill in Sun Prairie. Hi, Bill.
Hi. I understand your guest is history expert on water, but I also believe that historians make great forecasters of the future, so I'd like to ask this question. I have a number of friends and family that are considering moving to Florida, and there's about 10,000 baby boomers a day that are retiring, and a lot of them are considering moving to Florida. And I wonder if he could comment on the advisability of this, considering that, considering, number one, the cost and availability of water now there, but more importantly, I'm concerned about my grandchildren. If we were to move down there, does climate change mean that the seas will rise and eradicate the Florida coast? I'm wondering if you could answer that.
I'm in the middle of three books.
The three.
First is the water book. The second book, which I think is coming out next year, is a book on how we understand the ocean. The third book, which I'm just this moment beginning to work on is a book called The Attacking Sea, which is about sea levels. And there is a long, long history of human activity in the context of rising sea levels. And the thing about rising sea levels is it's rather like water, it's rather like confronting hurricanes. The more people you have around, the more vulnerable you are. And in ancient times, for example, you may not know this, the North Sea between Britain and the continent, much of it 7,000 or 8,000 years ago was dry land, and it flooded. And only now, with very sophisticated electronics, are they discovering its topography and the geography of it. And people, when it flooded, simply moved away. There weren't that number of people. They resettled. The Black Sea was flooded. Same thing. And we are now confronting a sea level rise of about a meter in the next century, so the experts tell us, the effects of which are going to be different in each place. I would personally be very careful if you're looking, and good for you, sir, looking to your grandchildren and maybe great-grandchildren, I would be extremely careful about moving to a high-density coastal city where you are in danger of seeing impact from sea levels, which are going to rise a meter, or impact in an era which is coming where there will be much more severe storms, because this is something else the climatic experts forecast. No, I can't give you lessons from history, but looking at the future of rising sea levels, I tend to be cautious about living in low-lying places. And having said that, the whole world will collapse around my head. How dare you say that? But you wanted an answer, there's one.
Well, let me ask you one. Would you live in Phoenix?
No.
Ooh, there was direct.
For various reasons. One, I'm an Englishman and I like cooler temperatures. That's just why I live in Santa Barbara. Two, I just don't like deserts, which has nothing to do with three. And three, I don't play golf and I don't want to spend the summer sitting in air conditioning.
All right.
Well,
I'm with you.
Nice people in Phoenix and some
I wouldn't live
there
either.
I'd only go in the winter.
Yeah. Well, there's something. You're a swimmer and you write poetically in the book about water. You really appreciate water. You don't just take it for granted. You think about water. It's important in your life.
It is very important. I mean, I'm a sailor. Not so much now as I used to be, but I sail a lot. And you develop this curious relationship with water, which is what my next book is about, which is about human relationships with water and the way we talk about the ocean, the way we feel it and how it's changed. And again, it's changed today. It's much more impersonal than it used to be for, say, Danish fishermen. It's fascinating stuff. Yeah, I have a relationship with water and I love it.
Yeah, I do too. I'm a swimmer, and you just give me, you know, a cool body of water, and I can spend hours. It's wonderful to
yes.
It's wonderful to be around water. This was interesting. Oh, I shouldn't even ask you. We only have a minute left, but you talk about where water coming from. Ancient societies believing that water flowed from the depths of the earth. Few Europeans believed that rain and snow could provide water, at least until Leonardo da Vinci suggested it.
Yes, we did. Mm-hmm.
Well, what do we think? Where do we think it came from?
I have no idea. I would imagine probably theological belief, probably.
Religious
belief.
Isn't that fascinating?
I mean, religious belief, it was so pervasive in its influence on philosophies 2,000 years ago. Well, it was.
Yeah. And if you were to zero in, you've covered so many different civilizations all over the world, the civilization that we were to study one at great, great length because they managed their water so beautifully and it was good for us to emulate, what would it be? What civilization?
It depends where you live. If you live in the rainy environment, I'd take a good look at the Inca. If you're looking at arid lands, I would look at Islam, I would look at the whole camp, but particularly Islam. It really depends where you live. And I would like to apologize for your callers for not knowing more about the modern situation, but believe me, the history was enough to deal with.
Right. Well, exactly. Don't apologize. Oh, please do not apologize. Okay. That's not what the book is about, and it's absolutely wonderful. Thank you so much, Brian, for being with us again and for this history of water.
Well, thank you, Kathleen. I hope to be with you again in the future.
I hope so, too. If you got three books going, we'll be talking to you again fairly soon. Brian Fagan is author of Elixir, A History of Water and Humankind. There's just a little tiny bit at the back of the book that looks at what our challenges are right now and how we need to think about this issue of water. He writes, to compound the problem now, 60% of the world's population lives in crowded river basins shared by several countries, often with daggers drawn at each other. So there are a lot of modern concerns, and that isn't the focus of this book, but it's a focus of concern for Brian. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour, Chrissy Pease for on-air production in our studios in downtown Milwaukee, right next to beautiful and very important Lake Michigan. Thanks, everybody, for your calls. This marks my 18th year here this week at Wisconsin Public Radio, so it's been good. Be with you Monday.